Welcome to the show, folks. My name is Josh Tully. This is the Josh Tully Show, GCN Radio Network. If you want to be part of it today, it's real easy. 1-800-259-5791. 1-800-259-5791. We have a very exciting guest coming up in a little bit, and I'm really, really fascinated by his book. We get a lot of authors on the show. And some of them are good, some of them we get on just because of their opinion on other things. But this is the story behind this book. I was sent a flyer, and it was just like a little trifold flyer, and it had to do with, you know, does the Constitution really jive with biblical law? And I read the flyer, and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. This should make for an interesting guest. So we contacted him, and he sent me a copy of the book. I'm not through the book yet. It's 580 pages. And I got to tell you, wow. Wow. You know how we grow up thinking, oh, well, you know, it's great American history that we are a Judeo-Christian country, and the Constitution is based on the Bible, and that's why it's so wonderful, and some denominations even think it's a living, breathing document. Turns out, yeah, we might have had that wrong. We might have had that way wrong. So wrong, in fact, that part of the reason why we're experiencing a decline is that we're operating under two systems here. We think that it has to do with biblical principles, but it really doesn't. And when we announced he was going to be on the show, somebody wrote in and said, well, you know, does it really matter? I mean, this is pointless because the Constitution is the law of the land, period, so why does it really matter? And it does really matter. It does, because one, I just hate being lied to, period. So all those years growing up and, you know, all through school, and even though I went to a secular state-run school, they kept telling them, well, the Constitution is based on Judeo-Christian beliefs and all that sort of stuff. So one, I just want to get to the bottom of that, because two, there are denominations in this country that actually believe it's divinely inspired. They really do. So to have this Constitution and have it be not what we think it is obviously a fascinating conversation, fascinating discussion. So get your questions ready. I'd love to hear them. Now, I hope you had a wonderful 4th of July. 4th of July is not about a celebration of freedom anymore, for our freedoms have been systematically removed. It's now a celebration of, well, essentially our captivity. Sad, isn't it? 9 out of the 10 amendments of the Constitution, gone, eradicated, totally infringed upon. So it's more of a celebration remembering who we were and who we hope to be once again. But whatever you were doing, I hope you had fun. You know, I've been looking forward to this conversation all weekend, and the fact that it was 4th of July just makes it more appropriate, I believe. And as we were talking about on the intro to this show, a lot of us think, well, you know, the United States Constitution, this thing is wonderful, it's awesome, it's based on Judeo-Christian values, and we're taught that in school, and we just grow up believing it. And with so many so-called Christians not even knowing what their Bible says, matter of fact, a recent poll showed more atheists know what the Bible say than Christians. A lot of us just go along with it. Somebody told us that it was based on biblical principles. Okay, fine, I believe you. Most of us have never read the Bible. Most of us have never read the Constitution. What if we were wrong? What if? So today we're going to find out, is it really biblical? And if it's not, or even if it is, does it really matter? And joining us to talk about that, we have Ted Whelan. He's the author of this book, and I highly recommend you get this book. I'm serious. It's called Bible Law versus the United States Constitution. Welcome to the show, Mr. Whelan. How are you doing?
Great, Josh. Actually, the last name is pronounced Whelan, and appreciate your invite to be on your show this morning.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, and forgive me for the mispronunciation.
That's all right. It looks like
Whelan. All right, let's start with this book.
I grew up in public grade school being Wee Whelan, so I always like to correct people that it's Whelan.
Sounds good. All right, so let's start with, does it really matter? I mean, a lot of people have said, since we told everybody you were going to be on the show, Josh, it really doesn't matter if it is or it isn't, because the Constitution's the law of the land anyway, so why even worry about it?
Well, that's a great question, and certainly one that needs to be answered. And I think that probably for your audience, and I don't care where they're coming from, what political spectrum they're coming from, everybody realizes, well, perhaps not the far left, but nearly everyone in America who has any sensibility still about them understands that we're on the precipice right now in America, and maybe already falling into the chasm of moral depravity and literally destruction of this nation, and therefore something's gone awry. Whether the Constitution is the supreme law of the land or not, something's gone awry, and there's got to be a reason for it. And of course, most people, as you introduced this so well, most people, and particularly Christians, ironically led by not just Christians but conservative Christians, have been at the forefront of promoting what I believe is the document that's at the very root, the very cause of why we're on that cliff right now. I have our featured article, blog article on our website is entitled Five Reasons the Constitution is Our Cutting Edge Issue. And most people would see the title and think we get to talk about the Constitution in a positive fashion. But it's five reasons, and there's literally hundreds of reasons why it is the cutting edge issue, because it is, in fact, the cause of why we find ourselves where we're at today. And unless we deal with the cause or deal with the genesis of why we're here, if in fact this is in fact true, what I just stated, then we're never going to be able to truly address this. We're just going to keep putting up Band-Aids on answers that are only covering up the real problems. Some of your audience may be familiar with Lysander Spooner, who was the great libertarian attorney of the middle 1800s, and he said, even in that day, he said the government, I don't have the quote right in front of me, but he said, the Constitution is either responsible for what government we find in effect at this time, or it was totally ineffective for keeping us from getting to this point. And how much more so now in where we find ourselves today. So if we're going to get to the root of it, what does it matter? Well, it matters if, in fact, it is at the root of why we find ourselves where we're at today.
Well, you know, that's a great point. I had a constitutional attorney on the show probably 6 months ago or so, and I asked him, you know, we went through the Ten Amendments, the Bill of Rights, and we discovered that nine of them have been totally infringed, with one possibly left. And I asked him, you know, if we were in a marriage or we were in some sort of government structure outside the Constitution or even a business agreement, and nine of the 10 foundational pillars of that agreement were eradicated, would that agreement still stand? And he said, I never thought about that, but the answer is no. So in a sense, even if we were to say, okay, well, Constitution's the law of the land, that doesn't exist in its intent anymore either, so it's a great point. So let's just go back in history a little bit then. Was the Constitution in its original structure by the Founding Fathers, everybody, you know, celebrating the Founding Fathers this weekend, was it originally intended to be a Judeo-Christian-based document?
Well, I think you only have to look at the document itself and the very fact that neither is God, Christ, His Word, His morality as His immutable morality as reflected in His triune moral law, His commandments, statutes, and judgments mentioned anywhere in the document whatsoever, which was a total aberration from America's documents previous to that point, and particularly what we find in the 1600s. And in the 1600 documents of the colonials, they literally based their constitutions upon the law of God. They wrote the law right into it and made no bones about it, that that's where they were coming from, that they were there to establish, very important point, to establish governments of, by, and for God based upon his immutable law, rather than humanistic governments of, by, and for the people, which nobody ever thinks about what that really is saying, based upon Enlightenment and Masonic, anti-Christian Masonic concepts. So there's a huge difference between our true Christian foundations in the 1600s and what we find taking place in the 1700s. You know, if there's a reason for why there has to be a defining point in America's history with the 1600 colonial constitutions based upon God's law, establishing America for the most part as a monotheistic Christian nation, and for that course to have been changed as radically as it has, and it has incrementally been done. It didn't happen overnight, but we find ourselves where we're at today because of that incremental change from some point in history, some defining point in history that changed the course of America. Well, all you have to do is go back to the 1787, when the late 1700 founders and framers of the Constitution established a humanistic government rather than a government of, by, and for God.
You know, that's so true. One of the quotes that hooked me on this book right away is, "The document that promotes the will of the people over Yahweh's will for his people is not compatible with the Bible." And I thought about that for a second, and it kind of, like, shot me. I was like, wow, that actually makes a lot of sense. So we'll dig a little bit deeper with Ted Weiland right after this break. Don't go anywhere, folks. So the Bible versus the Constitution, all these years I thought, well, wait a second, these things went hand in hand. Matter of fact, there's a denomination that's headquartered out of Utah that thinks the Constitution is divinely inspired. And you're entitled to your own beliefs. Absolutely. But the thing that I find interesting is, even if we don't believe in the Bible at all, because I know there's listeners out there like that, this is still an important conversation, because people vote on issues as if it were. How many in the Christian right or the Christian coalition, you go back to Reagan in the 80s, and the whole idea was, well, this is all biblical, and because it's biblical, it belongs to us, and an onward Christian soldier. And today we're realizing, hey, wait a second, maybe this doesn't actually match up. You know, part of the part of the book, Mr. Weiland, that I found interesting was that you point out between the early 1600s and about 1778, we kind of had a peak, if you will, and then ever since then, it's just been kind of a steady decline. And you suggest that 100 or so year period prior to is actually responsible for our success. Can you kind of dig into that a little bit?
Yeah, you bet. Let me share with you a scripture that certainly that's based upon, and particularly even promised, that God promises us that the reason why we would prosper. In this case, it was written to the Israelites, but the principle remains the same. Israelites of old, that is, under the Old Covenant, but the principle remains the same. In Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verses 4 through 8, he says, or Moses says, "Behold, I have taught you statutes, even as Yahweh," and I, by the way, for the sake of your audience, I've reinserted the Tetragrammaton, and therefore Yahweh, back into the text where God inspired it. There's almost 7,000 locations where it should be in the text where he inspired it, so that's why they'll hear me say Yahweh. Anyway, back to the beginning here, it says, "Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as Yahweh my God commanded me, that you should do so in the land whither you go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for," then it says, "for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, in the sight of all the other nations, which shall hear of these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great who has a God so high unto him as Yahweh our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day?" Now, the law there is not referring to the Mosaic Covenant, which they were under, but it's specifically referring to the moral commandments, statutes, and judgments of God. And therefore, God says, if you keep my commandments and my statutes and my judgments, I will bless you. In fact, Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 through 14, enumerates many of the blessings that come from God keeping God's laws. But note that in Deuteronomy 4, he says, not only will you be blessed, but you will be considered a great nation before all the other nations. Now, most people think that we were considered a great nation after the framers established the Constitution as a constitutional republic as our form of government. But our greatness came from our blessings don't come from rejecting God's law. Blessings come from keeping his law. And we've been on a track of refusing his law and refusing him as our God and King ever since 1788. Incrementally, we've been blessed as a nation, but the blessings come from keeping his law. And in fact, Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America, recognized that it was in the 1600s that we were great. If I can, I'll share a quote from him here that fits perfectly. I don't even know if he realized it with what I just read to you from Deuteronomy 4. He said, speaking of the colonies, he said, they exercised the rights of sovereignty, they named their magistrates, concluded peace or declared war, made police regulations, and enacted laws as if their allegiance was due only to God. Nothing can be more curious, and at that time, more instructive than the legislation of that period. It is there that the solution of the great social problems which the United States now presents to the world is to be found. Not the 1700s, but the 1600s. And then even goes on to say that they literally enacted laws, he says, copied verbatim from the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and so forth. So there's a perfect fulfillment of what God promises in Deuteronomy 24 here in 1600 America that Alexis de Tocqueville recognized. He was not speaking about the 1700s. He was not speaking about the Constitution of the United States of America. He was speaking of some of the constitutions of colonial America.
Well, Pam from Arkansas wrote in, and she said, well, can you please ask your guest if he is referring to Old Testament law or New Testament law? Because we were set free from the Old Testament law by grace, so is he referring to then keeping the law that we've been set free from?
So often to get these kind of questions, and often they're not even questions, people get quite irate over the fact that I would be promoting God's law. Think about this. To promote God as our God and our King, hopefully, as well. And in fact, Isaiah 33:22 says that Yahweh is our judge, law, and judge, King, and lawgiver. James 4:12 says that there's only one lawgiver. With that in mind, if we're promoting God as promoting Yahweh as our God, King, and Judge, then we're hopefully promoting what reflects His very essence. If we were to ask people who is God? Well, there's lots of different answers, but the one that's probably most important is dealing with who and what He is, which is found in His morality. And His morality is provided to us and reflected in His commandments, statutes, and judgments. Now, regrettably, most of modern Christianity is what's sometimes described as antinomian, and I need to probably define that term. The word nomia, the Greek word nomia, is the word that's most often translated law in the New Testament. Antinomian would be the majority, regrettably, tragically, where we find modern Christianity today, who are anti-law, anti-God's law under the New Covenant. Pronomian would be the opposite. Well, this really all started, this whole understanding of the Constitution came to came to me, I started to realize what the consequences were in all of this when I realized that the New Testament is not antinomian, but instead is pronomian. It is pro-God's law. Now, no one is justified by keeping God's law as they were required to and were unable to under the Mosaic Covenant. Our justification comes only through the blood atoning sacrifice and resurrection of Christ. However, that does not do away with God's morality, hopefully. Who would want to get rid of God's morality? Who would want to get rid of the Ten Commandments? Particularly since His law is described as perfect and His judgments as altogether righteous in Psalms 19. And to do away, therefore, to do away with His laws, Josh, is to do away with His morality, and to do away with His morality is to do away with God. So we better be careful that we define what law in any particular passage in the New Testament is being spoken of. And let me just share one verse that certainly very much pertains to this. The Apostle Paul, while he taught that we are not under the law but under grace in the New Covenant, praise God, he also wrote several things in his epistles promoting God's law still under the New Covenant. And for example, in Romans chapter 3 and verse 31, it says, "Do we then make void the law through faith or grace?" You could say, do we make void the law through faith? And I think if you were to ask the majority of today's, even today's preachers, that question, they'd say yes. But Paul answers his own question. He says, "God forbid, yea, we establish the law." So we're not under the law. We're not under the Mosaic Covenant, its requirement to keep the law perfectly in order to be justified. But we still are, the law is...
Well, hold on one second. We're up against a break.
Right.
Hold on one second. We'll continue this conversation right after this. Don't go anywhere. All right, we're talking to Ted Weiland of the book Bible Law versus the United States Constitution. I'm telling you, this is an absolutely fascinating book. You have to read it before the midterms. So before we get back into this, sir, where can people get the book? What's your website?
Okay, the website is BibleVersusConstitution.org. Versus is spelled out. Be sure you spell it correctly. Bible Versus, V-E-R-S-U-S, Constitution.org. BibleVersusConstitution.org. And let me mention something concerning the website. If your people would like to go, your listeners would like to go to the webpage, if they'll look to the right-hand side column, and let's see here, it's the fourth entry in the right-hand side column. Excuse me, it's the second one. It says, "Is the U.S. Constitution a Christian document survey?" There's 10 questions. If they'll take the survey and fill it out and go ahead and send it, they will get a free copy of the primer of the Big Book. The Big Book devotes a chapter to examining every article and every amendment by the Bible, something that just hasn't been done in the past. And it's 565 pages, and we realized, well, that's going to be too big for a lot of people except those who really want to get into it. So we reduced it down to what we call the primer, which is 85 pages, dealing with the most important articles and amendments in the preamble as compared to the Bible. And so if they'll take that Constitution survey, postage paid, we send them a free copy of the primer, and also some CDs to listen to and some other things as well.
Oh, how cool is that? Thank you for that. All right,
yeah.
So we were talking about a question Pam from Arkansas had about, you know, old law versus New Testament law. And then while we were talking about that, Fred from Wisconsin chimed in on this law issue and said, well, isn't it true that law isn't really law as we think it, but it's more like instruction?
Well, it's certainly that, but it's law as well. And I was hoping I'd be able to share with you, because we broke off right when I was going to go to it, and I didn't do a real good job there of explaining the harmony of God's law still under the New Covenant. But there's a quote that I want to share with your listeners that it's a one sentence quote that really sums up the New Testament perspective on God's law. This comes from Puritan minister Samuel Bolton, who lived between 1606 and 1654. And he wrote the following. He said, quote, "The law sends us to the gospel for our justification. The gospel sends us to the law to frame our way of life. If you think about it, that only makes sense. It's particularly since God's morality is reflected in his law, that once we're under the blood of Christ, once we're justified and redeemed by him, then what's incumbent upon us but to live for him? If we love him, we keep his commandments, is stated at least three times in the New Testament. And Christ's commandments were no different than the Father's commandments. In fact, he had to keep the moral law perfectly in order to be our sinless sacrifice. So it only makes sense that while we're not justified by the law, that the law sends us, the law, breaking the law is what sin is, his moral law, and therefore it sends us to the gospel for our justification. But once justified, then the gospel sends us to the back to the law to live our lives according to the desires or the will of our Heavenly Father. And again, as Paul said, the law has not been done away with by grace or by anything else, in fact. But instead, we establish the law now that we're in Christ. At least we should be. And regrettably, most of Christianity isn't.
And, you know, that's a good point to bring up something else, too. Even when we look at, okay, the law, and let's say all of it, 613 commandments, most of them don't apply to us anymore anyway. There's no temple, so worrying about temple services, those are out. You know, the ones that apply to women don't apply to men, so those are out. And in comparison, in the United States, the land of the free, or the supposedly free, we have 2.4 million rules, codes, laws, regulations, and ordinances. I would rather take my chances with the 613.
Great point. Let me share something with you that I love sharing because I think most people can relate to this very, very well. And I'm going to type in a passage to make sure I get this stated correctly. See if I've got it here. Well, it's not the right one. But anyway, you know, if you think about exactly with what you just said, Josh, you think about what the Constitution has brought on, and people say, well, it's been the abuse of the Constitution, but nevertheless, as Lysander Spooner said, if the Constitution was the document that everybody thinks it is, it would have kept us from this happening. But you think about what we now have under the Constitutional Republic. Well, if Moses had come down Mount Sinai with today's constitutional laws, I guarantee he would not have come down the mountain with two tablets. He'd have came down with the very least with a hernia, with a broken back, and an untold numbers of wagons pulled by both donkeys and elephants alike. And what's ironic about this, and the verse I wanted to share with you, it's from 1 John 5:4, I'm thinking it is now. Here it is, 5:3. In 1 John 5:3, I'll come back to it momentarily here, but regrettably, the majority of Christians and today's pastors are telling people that God's law is burdensome. We don't want that under the new covenant. Of course, if you're talking about the Mosaic covenant, it's a requirement to keep all the sacrifices. That is burdensome. But God's law that reflects his morality, most of today's preachers are calling burdensome. Well, I say, if you want burdensome, go look at what we've got under our constitutional republic today. And what's really ironic about them saying that is that the Apostle John in 1 John 5:3 writes the following. He says, "For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, of course, and his commandments..." Not talking Mosaic covenant here, but his commandments, the Ten Commandments and their respective statutes and judgments. His commandments are not, King James has grievous, New American Standard has burdensome. The exact opposite of what most preachers are telling their congregations today. God's law is burdensome. We don't want that. Well, the Mosaic covenant was burdensome, but God's laws are not burdensome, not if you believe the Apostle John.
Well, that's a great point, too. And, you know, Robert from Kansas wrote in and says, "Is your guest really advocating slavery and stoning our children? Because that's biblical law, too." What do you say to that?
Well, interesting, regarding the latter of the two, my latest two blog articles is WWJD, which most people recognize stands for What Would Jesus Do? So, What Would Jesus Do? are you sure you really want to know? And I think most Christians really don't want to know, because and the reason I bring this up is because in part one of that two-part blog series on our blog, I actually deal with the stoning issue. Well, what did Christ? Did most people don't even probably realize that Christ even dealt with that issue. How did Christ deal with the adulterous woman in John chapter 8? I deal with that in part two of that blog article. And most people get that completely contrary. In fact, most people, make Christ a sinner, and unable to be our Savior because they have Him changing the law rather than upholding the law. And if we're going to ask the question, what would Jesus do, and He upheld the law, then we're, our principal means of figuring out what Jesus would do is to go back to the law, the moral law of God, and follow it. So there's some difficult questions. Slavery is one of them, and actually I devote a whole chapter in the book to slavery because the Constitution deals with that issue as well. It's really not a question of slavery or no slavery. It's what kind of slavery, and we might want to even do away with that term for at least biblically, although it certainly can be used. But right now prisons are slavery. God has a much better plan than tax-subsidized prisons. In fact, under his law, there's no need for prisons whatsoever. Capital crime is to be punished immediately upon conviction, Ecclesiastes 8:11, and non-capital crimes, such as theft, are to be paid, are to be dealt with through restitution anywhere from 2 to 5 times, depending upon the nature of the crime, to be paid to the victim. And if they cannot pay it, they are to be put into indentured servitude until that debt is paid to their victim, and their indentured servitude or slavery, what some people might call slavery, is done away with at that time.
Well, Ted Weiland, thank you so much for joining us. That hour went by so fast. Maybe we'll talk him into sticking around for another segment. But either way, we'll be back right after this.